is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builders Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Another of our periodic check-ins with members of the Oregon State Legislature and State Senator Floyd Pazanski. Floyd, thanks for being on this afternoon.
Kyle, thank you for having me.
Well, I know a busy time in Salem. I wanted to ask you first, because we covered it in our newscast this morning and just a few minutes ago. This was a House vote yesterday, but it's a measure that started in the Senate, and I'm sure that you can share some thoughts about it. Oregon House voting yesterday on the firearm storage bill passed. Apparently, they made some changes, so now it goes back to the Senate. And it sounds like a lot of people are taking a look at that one with a variety of opinions.
That's correct. It's actually Senate Bill 554, and 554 was the one dealing with carrying firearms into public buildings. It got ratcheted back through some negotiations that occurred on the House side. Instead of being all state buildings, it will be limited to the state capitol, and that the local option has been removed for cities and counties and special districts, but will still be there for school districts to be able to consider on a district-by-district basis. What happened is the other bill that you're referring to, safe storage, was a bill that started on the House side, House Bill 2510, and through the process that they had in their Rules Committee on the House side, they basically took that bill and merged it into the bill that was passed by the Senate. So you now have the two bills, two concepts in one, which is now coming back to us as Senate Bill 554. But it does, in fact, have a good portion of the safe storage provisions that were in 2510. The next step is that since it has to come back because the original bill that we passed was modified, it has to come back for what's known either as a concurrence or non-concurrence vote by the full Senate. That will take place, I expect it to happen on Wednesday at this point, based on the timing of the when the bill will be in our possession, and then the protocol of getting it to the floor for a concurrence vote at this point.
I've read a variety of articles in the past 12 hours or so, or I guess starting last night, with perspectives on it. It sounded like while you did have in the House side three Democratic members joining the Republicans and voting against the bill, it doesn't look like any Republicans voted for it. And a lot of gun owners were, in comments I saw, pretty concerned and saying perhaps it went too far.
Yeah, so I think a lot of confusion is how both advocates and proponents both have basically coined and positioned themselves. A lot of the concern, I believe, at this point is really around some of the safe storage provisions as to what an individual gun owner has to do to be in compliance with the law, even within their own residence. And once I think people understand, at least my reading of the definitions that were provided to me, it is not as strict as some individuals have attributed it to be, that you have to have control over the gun and be able to, if it's not in your possession. And so I've had conversations with some of the constituents, especially some in more rural areas, and explaining that the bottom line is if you go and you leave your house and you've got your guns out in open display, yes, someone may have to break in to get to your guns in your house, but at the same time, as a responsible gun owner, is it appropriate to just let firearms be just laying out? Now, one of the other areas that they really covered on the House side with the 2510, which is now, again, part of 554, is the misuse of those guns, and not necessarily in criminal activity, but unfortunately in people that have mental health or just depression and use of those guns by, in many cases, youth for committing suicide.
And one of the comments I saw talked about a concern from someone in the rural area. I think this happened to be Josephine County, talking about having the weapons always stored. And they said, if somebody were to try to break into their house, police response, you know, might be quite a ways away, quite a lengthy time, and the inability to get to the firearm to protect their own property was a concern.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's a misunderstanding of what the law will require. It does not require that the gun always be locked up. It has to be in your control or under your authority. And so it's either in your possession or you have control under your authority. I own guns. The reality is if you feel that you need to have a gun available, open, it just needs to be close to you and one that you can access and control that weapon. So individuals who may be like it's sleeping, they want to have a gun that's in their night chest, desk or whatever close by. There's nothing there in that law that would prohibit them from doing that or holding them accountable by doing that so long as they have control over. Now, those are those type of situations, again, even though you see what the... And I think the concern really comes down to whether a gun has been safely stored when it's not in your possession and it's not under your control. That's really what the focus is trying to address. And again... the documentation has been shown, and unfortunately, that guns that are easily accessible sometimes have, in fact, been used to even take the person who's obtaining the access to that gun and sometimes youth within the house and killing themselves.
So what about the aspect of this that designates the Oregon State Capitol as a gun-free zone and also allows school districts, public universities, as you mentioned, to do the same?
Yeah, so a lot of individuals have misinterpreted what the Second Amendment provides for, and I think Anthony Scalia, who wrote the Heller decision, this is the 2008 decision at the U.S. Supreme Court, which was the very first interpretation of the Supreme Court that extended the Second Amendment rights to self-protection and defense for individuals having protections under the Second Amendment. In that opinion, Scalia made it very clear that the historical perspective and going forward, that there was not a prohibition from having reasonable time, place, and manner regulations. And we see that now, and it has been in place. I mean, you can go back to the early days of our statehood and see even like in Tombstone, Arizona, as a territory, that they actually had an ordinance that required everyone that was coming into town to basically check their gun at the sheriff's office or livery stable where you may be housing your horse while you're in town and stuff. So this is not something that just has happened in the last decade or two. I mean, this goes back over 100 years, 150 and some circumstances or locations. So regarding what's happening for the Capitol, current law right now is a concealed weapon permit holder has the authority to come into the Capitol even with a semi-automatic, fully loaded, coming in and walking down the hall with it. And so I think there's a lot of issues and concerns that a lot of people have as to what is the need for having open display firearms, ones that are ready to actually utilize when you're conducting business in the state capitol. That was extended in the original bill for state buildings as well. And then it was going to be local options for not only the schools, which still is in the bill, but also for local government entities, counties, cities, as well as special districts. The final version of the bill that passed out of the House that's coming back for concurrence on the Senate side is now limited only to school districts. And so now each community and each school district within a community can make a determination as to what works best for them and what they want. So there will have to be a process, since these are elected officials, the school board members, to actually address these concerns in open board meetings and allow for constituents of those school districts to come in and voice their opinion as to whether they should or shouldn't have some type of limitations on where firearms can or can't be brought onto school property. The one thing I will tell you that I was wished they would have left in the bill that I had put in when it was on the Senate side was to just call out that for families, adults who transport their children or neighbors' children to schools that are CHL holders, that they should be able to know that they can go to a location at the school, like in a parking lot or an ingress or degress lane, and actually drop the kids off, pick the kids up without having be, quote-unquote, in technical violation by being on school property with their gun that they have a lawful permit for. The House chose to take that portion out, and they're going to leave that discussion at the local level as well. So it will be true local control and decisions as to what parts of the property would or wouldn't have prohibitions for carrying firearms.
Going to take a break. We've got lots of other things to cover as well with State Senator Floyd Prezansky. The interview, a podcast after 1 at 541radio.com. Inside Douglas County, 1246 at News Radio 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1248. Lars Larson coming at 1 on News Radio 1240 KQEN. Monday's program, our weekly look at topics related to the COVID-19 situation with County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer. State Senator Floyd Prezansky on with us now. Many other things we could talk about. I'm curious, Floyd, with your work in the Judiciary Committee, what's been going on there?
Yeah, let me just finish up on that one thing about the local option for schools. That is, if they do adopt anything like that, they do have to put signage up, and they also have to put something on their web page so people know exactly what is or isn't permitted. Regarding judiciary itself, we're at a stage where all the other public policy committee committees are at this point, and that's basically starting to shift into all of our focus as to bills that were placed by, passed by the, in this case, the House to the Senate, and that have been assigned to our committee. So I am in the process of now going through with my judiciary council staff to determine which of those bills and how they're going to be scheduled in our committee. We got word on the Senate side, because the Senate Republicans have determined as of this week that they wanted every bill to be read in its entirety. We're going to be now shifting from where we were on the floor up to 3 days a week this week, and previously we're now be going every day of the week, 5 days a week, and we're looking at whether we're going to be meeting for 4 to 8 hours a day on the floor to try to keep up with the work that needs to be done because of the delay in requiring every bill to be read before we vote on the third reading. So that's kind of the shift in dynamics. We're still, meaning the leadership is working with the minority leaders to try to get through some of these rough times as to what is going to be required. But there are some, let's say, idle threats, sword sabering, rattling going on as to not wanting to work in the evening hours. And such, and so I'm just not sure exactly where we're going to be until next week once we get started, but you can count on the committee probably needing to adjust their times to give more time for floor sessions, at least the afternoon committee. So that in itself will cause some delay and some determination as to how many bills will be able to be processed through committees and still be able to do our work on the floor.
Now, obviously, this is similar to what was going on earlier in the House, and I think I heard at one point they were going up till 7 or 8 in the evening after starting at 7 or 8 in the morning. This could be a very lengthy day.
It could be. We're going to be starting at 10:30 as compared to 11 right this first of this next week. I think the president's going to be looking at expanding that potentially from a range from 10 a.m., to potentially till 5, probably without a break for quote-unquote lunch. People will be on their own if necessary to move bills. And then committees that would be normally meeting during the time that they're on the floor would probably be shifted to the evening hours. And that's one of those situations where I personally would like to see all sides kind of get together and huddle and figure a way that we can continue to do the work we need to get done without extending the hours that long, just because I think it really does impact the constituents' ability to participate when you start getting into more evening hours, because People are home. They're trying to take care of the family, get everyone fed, get you know, homework done that needs to get done, etc. You know, hopefully some of this stuff will work out. There's multiple reasons that have been given why the Senate Republicans are now requiring us to read every bill in verbatim before voting on it. But it runs the gamut of the gun bills that we just spoke about, as to being concerned that maybe there was other deals that were being made that weren't honored on the House side when they came back out to the Senate. To the governor declaring the extreme risk in 15 counties that went into effect today. So, I mean, there's a lot of, I guess, potential reasons that we find ourselves in this position. But it's one of those ones that really does cause us as a legislature, I think, to really start understanding, you know, the need for communication, open dialogue, so we can, in fact, actually finish the work that we need to do, including many budgets. You know, the reality is, if we get starved out, quote unquote, and these budgets don't get passed, that means we'll have to be coming back in the special session.
And that special session, I suppose, could basically flip and just be within a very short time of the mandatory end of the main session, right?
It could. It could be, yes. Under the current statutes that we have, we, the legislature, have the ability with the supermajority vote of the chambers to extend the length of the session, I believe, up to 5 days in periods. So we could, in fact, on our own say, hey, we're almost there, let's go for another 5 days and be done. Or it could be one that the governor could call us back in. And clearly, because of the requirement of quorum, if one or two or a group of individual legislators choose not to participate in that process, it could, in fact, deny quorum, so we would not be able to maintain a lot of policy at our programs and that are serving our constituents because they won't have the funding to continue.
And, right, because you're coming up at the end of June to the end of the fiscal year, end of the current budget, going into the next one, and with a lot of things still really pretty up in the air.
A lot. I just had an hour call with the two co-chairs for the Ways and Means for the Senate side, going over the bills that were referred from our committee, meaning my committee of judiciary, to the Ways and Means process. And you can only imagine, with that's just one committee, and they met with me for an hour, and I had a team of four staff attorneys trying to go through the various bills. So they're backing up, and there's just one of those situations that due diligence. We need to get the work done, and I understand, because I was in the minority for 7 years that I've served in the legislature, and you don't always agree with what the majority is doing, but the will of the people have put the majority in place, and to me, I'd rather have people show up for work like I did and voice your concerns on the floor, vote no, but be part of the process. I mean, it's you know, picking up the tools or your box and walking away and not even participating really is a disservice, I think, to the process that we have as democracy, but really to making certain that constituents are represented. Because if you're not there, you know, committees can meet. Committees have the ability to meet on a quorum, and based on the configuration, the committees will be able to meet even if there are walkouts. It really gets down to the point of when we have bills on the floor, we're not able to move them. And those bills, again, are budget bills as well as policy bills.
So for the current sort of protocols, how many folks are actually in the Capitol versus others being virtual?
Well, to be in the way of legislators, all of us need to be there for votes. In the sense of when we're on the floor, we have to vote through that process. Now, we can vote in committee virtually, but for floor votes, stuff that are actually on the chamber floors, you have to be there. And so the House is working a little bit different than we are because they have more members, and their space, even though it's larger as a chamber, you have the, you know, the confines. As you well know, there's been at least three, if not four, confirmed COVID cases that have occurred. Let's say attributed to House members, personnel. I'm not sure exactly who all have been actually identified because we don't have access to that information, not that we should. But that's because they had people on the floor for such a long time with so many people, and their air, the ventilation HVAC system just doesn't necessarily remove all that air out of there that could, in fact, be contaminated. On the Senate side, we're a little bit more fortunate because we only have 30 members, and because we've expanded what we call the bar with where the floor is to the galleries, you can now be considered on the floor while you're sitting on the second floor, the gallery section of the chamber. So you're able to spread out and move around, and you know, especially now with the reading of the bills, because some of these bills may take 30, 40 minutes to read the bill in its entirety. Many people are leaving the floor and then coming back when we're ready to actually take and cast the vote.
Well, interesting times in Salem. State Senator Floyd Przanski, thanks for being on with us this afternoon.
Kyle, thank you again. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.
1258 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN. A daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications. Your home for Douglas County's news team. News Radio 1240 KQEN.